A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's got a question about something most people deal with, but almost nobody teaches. How to redirect a conversation away from a topic you don't want to touch, without making the other person feel like they stepped on a landmine. He frames it around his own experience. He grew up Jewish in Ireland, now lives in Israel, and he doesn't want to discuss what it was like to be Jewish in Ireland or whether his family still there faces anti-Semitism. It's not that he has nothing to say about it. He's thought about it for most of his life, and his view is that anti-Semitism in Ireland was widespread but often dismissed even by relatives. That's a heavy thing to carry in the small talk with someone you barely know. His question is practical. What are the tactful ways to steer around something like this? He's looking for techniques that communicate a boundary without making the other person feel judged or shrugged off. And he suspects most people have their own version of this, a short list of subjects that are just not for casual conversation.
He's right about that last part. If you stopped 100 people on the street and asked them to name 3 topics they'd rather not discuss with someone they've just met, I'd be surprised if you got more than a handful who couldn't come up with any. The list varies: money, fertility struggles, a parent's death, a divorce, political views they hold but know are unpopular in their social circle. But the structure is the same. These are things that carry weight, and dropping them into a conversation with a near stranger feels like handing someone a suitcase you've been carrying and asking them to hold it.
And Daniel's framing it as a boundary-setting exercise, which I think is exactly right. He's not asking how to lie or deflect permanently. He's asking how to say, this particular door isn't one I'm opening right now, in a way that lets the conversation keep moving.
What I find interesting is the specific tension he names. He says he could just say, I don't like talking about this, can we move on? And he's done that occasionally. But he'd rather not be that blunt. He attributes that preference to his Irish cultural background. And there's probably something to that. Cultures vary enormously in how direct you're expected to be about personal boundaries. But I think even people from cultures that pride themselves on directness often find this particular maneuver uncomfortable. It's one thing to be blunt about facts. It's another to be blunt about your own pain.
The well-meaning relative problem. Someone asks what they think is a perfectly reasonable question. What was it like growing up Jewish there? And they have no idea. They've just put their foot in something that's been there for decades. They're flying blind, as Daniel put it. And now you have to decide, in about half a second, whether to give the real answer, the short answer, or no answer at all.
So let's build a toolkit. I've thought about this from a few angles, and I think the techniques fall into roughly 3 categories. There's the bridge and pivot, where you acknowledge the question briefly and then move the conversation somewhere adjacent. There's the preemptive frame, where you shape the conversation before it ever gets near the minefield. And there's the honest but contained response, which is closest to what Daniel's already doing, but with a softer delivery.
Walk me through bridge and pivot first. I think that's probably the one people reach for most naturally, even if they don't have a name for it.
The structure is simple. You give the question about 1 sentence of acknowledgement, enough to show you heard it and you're not ignoring it, and then you immediately pivot to something related but safe. So if someone asked Daniel what it was like being Jewish in Ireland, the bridge might be. Ireland's a complicated place for a lot of communities, and then the pivot, what I actually love talking about is how much has changed in Israel since I moved here. The tech scene alone is unrecognizable from even 5 years ago. You haven't answered it, but you've given them a clear signal about where you'd rather take things, and most people will follow.
Most people. The ones who don't are the problem.
Right, and we'll get to those. But the bridge and pivot works because it does two things at once. It preserves the social surface. The conversation doesn't lurch to a halt, and it teaches the other person what you're interested in discussing. Over time, people who talk to you regularly learn your map. They learn that Ireland roots to Israel or tech or whatever your preferred destination is.
There's a version of this that I think is underused, which is the enthusiastic redirect. You don't just pivot. You pivot to something you're excited about, and you bring enough energy that the other person gets swept along. If someone asks about a topic you hate and you respond with a flat, "Anyway, how about that weather?" they feel the deflection. If you respond with, "Oh, actually, that reminds me. I've been meaning to ask someone about this thing I read on agricultural policy, and you're clearly interested. The transition feels organic even though you've just performed a conversational judo throw."
Conversational judo. I'm keeping that.
It's yours.
The preemptive frame is a different animal entirely. This is for situations where you know the topic is likely to come up and you want to head it off before anyone says the words. Daniel mentioned briefing documents and diplomatic meetings. Those exist partly so nobody accidentally wanders into the wrong subject with a foreign minister. You can do a version of this in personal conversation. When you're meeting someone new and you sense the conversation drifting toward dangerous waters, you can set the frame early. "I moved here from Ireland a while back. Happy to talk about life here, less interested in rehashing the old country, if that makes sense." Said lightly, with a smile, and then you move on. You've drawn the boundary before anyone crossed it.
That's elegant because nobody has to apologize. Nobody has to backtrack. You've just put up a small sign that says, "Please don't go here," and if they're paying any attention at all, they won't.
The risk with the preemptive frame is that it can sound like you're making a big deal out of something before anyone's even brought it up. If you deliver it with too much gravity, the other person thinks, "Well, now I really want to know what's behind that door." So the tone matters enormously. It has to be casual, almost throwaway. You're not confiding a trauma. You're just indicating a preference, the same way you might say you'd rather sit inside than on the patio.
The third category, the honest but contained response. This is the one Daniel says he's used occasionally. The direct, "I don't like talking about this." How do you soften that?
I think there are a few ways. One is to pair the boundary with a small piece of context that closes the door without opening it further. Something like, "That's a topic with some personal history I'd rather not get into, but I appreciate you asking." The "I appreciate you asking" is important. It signals that you're not offended, you're not judging them for bringing it up, you just have a fence there. Another version is to take responsibility for the boundary rather than making it about the question. "I'm not great at talking about that period of my life, still sorting through it, honestly. Now it's about you and where you are, not about them and what they asked."
Still sorting through it is good. It's honest without being detailed, and it implies that this is a work in progress, not a permanent ban. Even if it's a permanent ban.
The other thing I'd say about the direct approach is that it works better the second or third time you see someone. The first time, it can land as a rebuke, because they don't know you yet and they can't calibrate. But if you've had a few good conversations with someone, and then they wander into your no-go zone, saying, "I'd rather not go there," lands differently. They have a baseline of warmth with you, so they can interpret the boundary as a boundary and not as a rejection.
There's a skill here that I think separates people who are good at this from people who struggle with it, which is reading whether the other person is asking out of genuine curiosity or whether they're probing. Daniel mentioned a well-meaning relative. That's the easy case. Someone who doesn't know. The harder case is someone who's testing you, seeing what you'll say, maybe even looking for a reaction. And I suspect Daniel's encountered both.
I'm sure he has, and the technique changes depending on which one you're dealing with. With genuine curiosity, any of the methods we've described will work, because the person isn't invested in the topic, they just asked a question that seemed natural. With a prober, you need something firmer, and you need to deliver it without escalation. The boundary has to be clear enough that pushing past, it'd be visibly rude. "I don't discuss that," full stop, no apology, no explanation, is a complete sentence. It's not warm, but it's not hostile either. It's just a wall.
And if they keep pushing?
Then you're not in a boundary-setting conversation anymore. You're in a situation where someone is deliberately ignoring a boundary you've clearly stated, and at that point the social contract is already broken. You're free to end the conversation, walk away, change the subject to something aggressively banal, whatever you need to do. You don't owe politeness to someone who's refusing to take no for an answer.
I want to go back to something Daniel said about not wanting to make the other person feel judged. I think that's the anxiety underneath a lot of this. People worry that setting a boundary will read as, you asked a bad question, and you're a bad person for asking it. And most of the time, that's not what's happening. Most of the time, someone asked a perfectly reasonable question that just happens to land on your particular sore spot. They couldn't have known.
The distinction I draw is between the question being inappropriate and the question being unfortunate. An inappropriate question is one that most people would recognize as out of bounds, asking a stranger about their salary, their sex life, their medical history. An unfortunate question is one that's perfectly normal in the abstract but happens to touch something specific for you. Where did you grow up? Is an innocuous question. For Daniel, it leads somewhere complicated. That's not the asker's fault.
So part of the skill is signaling that distinction in your response. You're not saying, how dare you? You're saying that particular avenue is closed, through no fault of yours.
And one way to do that's to immediately re-engage on a different topic with warmth. The pivot isn't just a deflection, it's a reassurance. I'd rather not get into the Ireland stuff, but tell me more about that project you mentioned earlier. I was interested. You've drawn the line and then immediately demonstrated that you still want to talk to them. The relationship survives the boundary.
I think there's also a case for the partial answer. You don't go into the thing you don't want to discuss, but you give them something adjacent that satisfies the curiosity without opening the wound. Daniel could say, Ireland's got a small Jewish community. Always has. About 2,500 people these days, I think. But I've been in Israel for years now, and that's really home. He's given them a fact, he's acknowledged the question, and he's steered toward the present. Most people will take the fact and follow the steer.
2,500 is about right for the current Jewish population in Ireland. It's been declining for decades. That's a factual answer to a factual question, and it doesn't require him to talk about his own experience at all.
The partial answer also works because it satisfies the asker's surface-level curiosity. A lot of the time, people aren't digging for your personal trauma. They just want to understand something about you, and they're using the available hooks. You're from Ireland is a hook. If you give them a different hook, I work in AI, I'm into open source development, I have a kid, they'll grab that one instead.
This connects to something I've noticed about how people build mental models of each other. When you meet someone new, you're assembling a rough sketch. Where are they from? What do they do? Who are they connected to? The questions people ask are often just them trying to fill in that sketch. If you give them richer material for a different part of the sketch, they'll happily draw there instead. The problem arises when the only interesting thing they know about you is the thing you don't want to discuss.
Which is an argument for being interesting in multiple directions.
It absolutely is. If the most distinctive thing about you is your relationship to a painful topic, people are going to keep gravitating toward it. But if you're also the person who builds AI agents, or the person who knows everything about workflow orchestration, or the person with strong opinions about speech-to-text models, you've given them other doors to knock on.
Daniel's got plenty of those, to be fair. The man ships open-source projects at a rate that's honestly a little concerning.
So the raw material is there. The question is just about managing the conversational traffic.
Let's talk about what not to do. Because I think there are some common moves that feel like they should work and actually make things worse.
The big one is the over-explanation. Someone asks a question you don't want to answer, and instead of a clean redirect, you give them a paragraph about why you don't want to answer it. Now you're talking about the thing you didn't want to talk about, just from a meta angle, and you've signaled that this is a very sensitive subject, which paradoxically makes some people more curious.
The other one is the joke deflection that lands wrong. Humor can work. A quick, oh, we'd need a whole other dinner for that conversation, and then a pivot. But if the joke is too dark or too flippant, it can read as you being dismissive of their question, which is exactly what Daniel's trying to avoid.
The joke also has to match your relationship with the person. With a close friend, you can say, absolutely not touching that one, and laugh, and they'll laugh too and move on. With someone you've just met, the same line can sound like you're mocking them for asking.
There's also the trap of the apologetic boundary. I'm so sorry. I know you're just being friendly. I don't mean to be difficult. It's just that now the other person feels like they have to apologize too, and you're both in a spiral of mutual discomfort, and the conversation is derailed anyway.
The apologetic boundary often comes from the same place as the over-explanation, a desire to manage the other person's feelings about your boundary. But you can't manage their feelings and hold the boundary at the same time. You have to pick one, and the boundary is more important.
That's the thing I think Daniel's really circling. He doesn't want to be rude. He doesn't want to make anyone feel bad. But he also doesn't want to have this conversation. And at some point, you have to accept that holding a boundary might cause a tiny moment of awkwardness. And that's okay. Awkwardness passes. A conversation you didn't want to have stays with you.
The awkwardness is the cost of the boundary, and it's almost always smaller than you think it's going to be. Most people don't dwell on the moment you change the subject. They're too busy thinking about what they're going to say next.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about cultures varying in how direct you're expected to be. Daniel specifically named his Irish background as part of why he'd rather not be blunt. Is there actually research on this, or is it just folk wisdom?
There's a fair amount of work on cross-cultural communication styles, and one of the dimensions that comes up consistently is directness versus indirectness in managing social friction. Some cultures, a lot of Northern European and North American contexts, tend to value clarity and directness, even when it creates momentary discomfort. Other cultures place a higher premium on maintaining social harmony and saving face, which means boundaries get communicated through hints, third parties, or elaborate softening. Ireland isn't the most indirect culture in the world, but it's certainly not the most direct either. There's a strong norm around not making things awkward, not being seen as difficult.
Which means Daniel's working with two layers. There's the universal difficulty of setting a boundary about a painful topic, and then there's the cultural layer that says setting a boundary directly is itself a minor social violation.
And he's now in Israel, where the communication style is, let's call it, considerably more direct. So he's navigating between two different sets of expectations about what counts as polite.
That's a tricky position. In Ireland, his indirect redirect might be read as perfectly appropriate. In Israel, the same move might be read as evasive, and someone might just ask again.
Which is why having multiple techniques matters. The bridge and pivot might work beautifully in one context and fall flat in another. The direct approach might feel rude in Dublin and completely normal in Jerusalem. Part of social skill is reading the room and picking the right tool.
I think there's one more technique worth naming, which is the pre-answer. Before someone can ask the question you're dreading, you answer a different question they haven't asked yet. So if Daniel senses someone is about to ask about being Jewish in Ireland, he might say, "You know, the thing that surprised me most about moving to Israel was how quickly it felt like home. I thought it'd take years, and it took about 3 weeks." He's preempted the Ireland question by volunteering the Israel answer. The conversation moves forward, and the question never gets asked.
That's skillful. It requires some anticipation. You have to see the question coming, but it avoids the whole problem of having to deflect after the fact. You're not shutting anything down because nothing was ever opened.
It's also generous, in a way. You're giving them something personal and genuine. You're just choosing which personal thing to give.
The pre-answer works best when you can read the conversational trajectory. Someone learns you're from Ireland, they're about to ask the obvious follow-up, and you jump the tracks before they get there. It takes practice, but it's learnable.
All of this is learnable, I think. That's what I'd want Daniel to take from this. These aren't personality traits, they're skills. You can practice them, you can get better at them, and you can have a bad day where you fumble one and still be fine.
The other thing I'd say is that the list of topics you don't discuss gets easier to manage the more you've thought about it in advance. Daniel's done that work. He knows exactly what his list is and why those things are on it. A lot of people haven't. They get ambushed by a question and only realize in the moment that they don't want to answer it, and then they're improvising while also processing an emotional reaction. That's the hardest version of this.
So part of the advice is, know your list. Know what's on it and why. Have a few pivot destinations ready. If you've rehearsed even a little, not scripted, just thought through, you'll be faster and smoother when it counts.
And give yourself permission to be imperfect at it. You're going to have moments where you're too blunt or too vague, or you accidentally open the door you meant to close. That's fine. The goal isn't perfect boundary management. The goal is boundary management that's good enough most of the time.
Daniel, if you're listening, you're already doing the hard part. You know what you don't want to discuss, and you know why. The techniques are just delivery mechanisms.
My brother-in-law sells industrial kitchen equipment. Has for 30 years. He's got opinions about everything, and about half of them are wrong. But he's got this one move I've watched him do at probably 50 family dinners. Someone brings up a topic he doesn't want to touch. Could be politics, could be money, could be why he and my sister weren't at the last wedding, and he just says, you know, I'm the wrong guy for that one. And then he asks them about their car. It works every time. The man has never answered a difficult question in his life, and somehow everyone thinks he's charming.
I'm the wrong guy for that one. That's almost elegant in its humility.
It's a lie, mostly. He's exactly the right guy for most of those questions. He just doesn't want to answer them. But the frame is self-deprecating. He's not saying the question is bad. He's saying he's not qualified. And then the car thing. People will talk about their cars for 20 minutes if you let them.
There's a principle there. The redirect works better when you hand them something they want to talk about.
He keeps a mental list of what everyone drives. I've seen him do it with people he met 5 minutes earlier. Finds out they've got a 2018 Skoda Octavia, and suddenly that's his entire personality for the next quarter hour. How's she running? Any trouble with the gearbox? I heard the diesel ones had an issue with the particulate filter. He doesn't care about their car. He cares about not talking about whatever they were about to ask him.
So he's got a library of safe topics keyed to specific people.
A library of cars, mostly, but the principal transfers have something ready that they'll bite on. He says the trick is picking something they're proud of. Nobody's proud of their mortgage rate. Everyone's proud of their car, their garden, their kids' test scores. Ask about the thing they want to tell you about anyway, and they'll forget they ever asked you anything.
That's good advice. The best redirect doesn't feel like a redirect. It feels like you just got interested in something else.
He also says you should never explain why you don't want to talk about something. Not even a little. The moment you start explaining, you've opened a negotiation. The other person thinks, oh, if I just address their concern about the topic, we can still have the conversation. He says boundaries with explanations aren't boundaries. They're invitations to haggle.
Your brother-in-law sounds like he's thought about this more than most therapists.
He's thought about it because he's got things he doesn't want to discuss, and he's been avoiding them for 3 decades. He's not a deep man, but he's effective. He also says, and I should mention, he's not what you'd call a reliable source on most subjects. He says the people who are worst at this are the ones who think they owe everyone an authentic version of themselves at all times. He says authenticity is a luxury for people with nothing to hide. The rest of us need a few diversions in our pocket.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but there's a grain of truth in it. You don't owe every conversation partner full access to your interior life.
That's what he'd say. Then he'd ask about your car.
What does he drive?
A 2007 Toyota Hilux. He says it's the most boring vehicle ever manufactured, and that's exactly why he bought it. Nobody asks follow-up questions about a Hilux.
The misconception people have about boundary setting in conversation is that it's fundamentally about saying no, that you're shutting something down, closing a door, refusing a request. But the actual skill is about offering an alternative. Every technique we talked about today, the bridge and pivot, the preemptive frame, the partial answer, your brother-in-law's car maneuver, they all work because they don't just close one door, they open another one at the same time. The boundary is real, but it's not the whole message. The whole message is not that, but this.
And this has to be genuine. It can't be a fake topic you don't actually care about. People can tell when you're just throwing conversational chaff. The redirect works when you're interested in the thing you're redirecting to, or at least interested in them.
Daniel's got plenty of genuine interest to redirect toward. The question is just practicing the pivot until it feels natural. One thing I keep coming back to. He mentioned that he's occasionally had to use the direct approach, and it sounds like it worked. The world didn't end. The conversation moved on. So maybe part of the answer is just trusting that you can do this, and people will mostly be fine with it.
Most people want the conversation to go well as much as you do. They're not invested in making you uncomfortable. Give them an off-ramp and they'll take it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us on track and for the brother-in-law wisdom.
If you've got your own techniques for navigating conversational minefields, we'd love to hear them. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.